You're listening to a Hebrew in Israel podcast with Yoel Halevi, exploring the language, culture, and history of the Bible. For more information, visit us at HebrewInIsrael.net.
We are studying the book of Deuteronomy. Last week, we did an introduction to the book. I have to point out that the introduction itself is only a partial introduction. This was something that only partially touches on a lot of the questions that that have to do with the book of Deuteronomy, and the thing that basically comes up from this entire discussion is the reality that we need to understand that this is a very, very complicated book. No matter how we look at it, it's a complicated book, and this is why there's a lot of research on the book as well. This is why I myself am involved in researching the book. And the book of Deuteronomy is a very, very fundamental book from a very important perspective. The reason it's very fundamental is because it's really a Mishneh Torah. It's a situation where the Torah is being reintroduced to the people. And it works off of the idea that before we enter the land, there's a need to renew the covenant. Renewal of covenant is something that I think a lot of people don't really stop to think about because it's not very common in the Bible. And we don't really hear a lot of ceremonies of, in the Bible about renewal of covenant. It only looks to us like as if, oh, it's just, you know, they're doing a ceremony. But it's not really true. The point is that covenants is something that you have to be always aware of, always moving around with the notion that it's there. And that's really what Deuteronomy does. Deuteronomy puts down this foundation of the idea that this is a covenant that has to be kept throughout all generations. Even though we hear this idea in other parts of the Torah, for example, the laws of the Passover point this idea out. We still have to remember that the book of Deuteronomy is designed in a way where it kind of stands alone, but not exactly. And this is what makes Deuteronomy so unique. This is also why it's referred to as, like, for example, the book of Moses. And it's really the first place where we really hear a reference to the idea of Torah, as if the idea of the instructions are being presented as an organized mechanism. Even though so far everything is been organized, it's the first time you really see the word Torah being used in the sense of like a specified book and so on. As I explained last week, this is also a very clearly a covenant book. And a covenant book usually stands by itself. One of the problems that we have, and I've been looking into this for quite a while, is the fact that when we look at a Torah scroll, we're talking about the material of Torah scrolls, not Torah as a concept, but the material discussion. And I actually attended a seminar back in October, somewhere in the beginning of October. I attended a seminar that dealt with the question of the material that books are written on. Like, for example, can we talk about a scroll when it's digitized? Have we changed something about the scroll? Is there a possibility that we misrepresent the scroll when we digitize one, and so on? Because even if you scan it as it is, there's sometimes things inside that you don't necessarily see unless you examine the actual scroll itself or the actual book. Like, for example, there was a lady, I was listening to one of her lectures, and she was talking about the fact that they were looking at a manuscript written in a codex. I think it was the researcher from Italy. There was one from Italy and there was another lady from Scotland. So I think it's the lady from Italy. She pointed out that even though they've digitized the book, and it's pretty amazing what they've done because it was actually a 3D digitization, which means you actually could look at the book from different angles. And she gave us a demonstration. She said, look, you still have one very simple problem, that even if you're scanning a book, you're losing something of the book itself. And she said, one of the issues that comes up is sometimes that there are details of the book that you can never digitize. Like, for example, if there's someone changed something in a text, or there's something underlaying somewhere, a digitization won't always be able to tell you what's going on. So there's a certain fallacy that we get when we talk about a Torah scroll, because when we look at a Torah scroll, we're talking about a process that went on for a very, very, very long time. Now, why do I bring this up? I bring this up because the book of Deuteronomy is the first time, not the first time, sorry, that would be incorrect. Because Moses does this at Mount Sinai. He writes a book of covenant, and he uses it in a ceremony. Again, this is why I said, and I actually point this out in my copy of Beckman's collection of Hittite documents. I marked on the side a couple of times, like, you know, this resembles the book of Exodus. This resembles the book. I did it a couple of times. And what's very, very important is to understand that we are looking at a certain parallel of Exodus in Deuteronomy. And the fact that we have this parallel where Moses has to speak to the people and he puts down stipulations, because you have to remember, when does Moses actually go up to the mountain? After the commandments are given. Now, Deuteronomy reverses some elements. In Deuteronomy, your feasts are mentioned prior to the stipulations of the civic law. In Exodus, it's the other way around. You have all the civic laws, all the criminal laws, and so on. And then at the end, you have a reference to the feasts. So they're not exactly mirroring one another, but you have the idea of presenting them one in front of the other. Now, this is a really, really important thing, because one of the elements of the research that I'm doing right now, and I had a very funny back and forth with the professor who's instructing me about this paper, is the fact that we don't have to look, when we compare documents, like, for example, when I compare Hittites or Neo-Assyrian documents with the book of Deuteronomy, I don't have to look for an exact copy. I only have to look for elements. And there was a book that I found, written by a lady called Crouch. I think the way it's spelled, it should be Crouch. And actually, from the beginning, I thought it was a man, because the name, her first name, wasn't very clear to me. And what she does there is she tries to say, look, to prove you have to have exact copying. It has to be an exact copy. So she on that basis rejects the idea that we might have, and again, this is just from the research, from just for research purposes, not faith purposes, but she says to prove that the book of Deuteronomy is similar to the Assyrian documents, then there has to be a word for word copy. Now, not only is that a completely preposterous idea, and I actually wrote that to my professor, and lo and behold, he wrote back to me saying the exact same thing. The thing that basically happens is that we have to remember that there's a principle paraphrasing. There's a principle paraphrasing. And the principle of paraphrasing is very, very important, because it explains a lot of what goes on in the book of Deuteronomy. The book of Deuteronomy is always referred to as the Mishneh Torah, as the secondary Torah, or the other document that's part of the Torah. And we have two major problems. The first problem is the physical issue. The physical issue is the fact that when we look at a Torah scroll, we see one gigantic scroll. We never think about the possibility that these scrolls are not supposed to be put together. And again, lo and behold, when you look at Qumran, you discover that there is no such thing as a gigantic Torah scroll. No such thing. Does not exist. We don't hear about a full-blown Torah scroll until a latter period. Now, I don't know the historical discussion about the physicality of Torah scrolls, but I do know that we have details about the Dead Sea Scrolls that indicate that people used to keep these books separate from one another, and they were written in separate scrolls. And that's just fact. That's just something that we know as fact. And there's no signs of, like, say, for example, books were torn apart or something, because you would see. But the difference is that when we have a scroll, you can see the beginning and end flaps. What you do with a scroll is that you basically leave at the end, and especially in the beginning, like half a page. So if you have a Torah scroll, and I wish I would have brought a piece of parchment with me or something, but if a Torah scroll, you basically have, if you've seen a Torah scroll, I assume some of you at least have seen, so you basically have columns. And what you do is you leave something like the size of a column as a flap that goes over. If there's any damage to the ends, to the edges or the ends, it keeps the writing safe. So you have space on the top, space on the bottom, space in the beginning, the end, even space between columns to make sure that everything is also well organized. So what happens is that we can't see, if we have a scroll where there is a flap, you don't see a tear there that can indicate someone tore up a seam or something like that. So the scrolls are basically physically separated from one another. So we have this first problem that when we look at a Torah scroll, we see one gigantic book instead of realizing that really these are five separate books and there's a relationship between them, but they weren't seen as one large book. Unlike, for example, the 12 minor prophets that from the Qumran scrolls, we actually see they were all written as one large scroll. Which is, by the way, practiced to this very day in synagogues. In synagogues that actually do have scrolls that they read from, like for example, the community I was in when I lived in Jerusalem, we had special scrolls, and they would read. It's like a little Torah scroll, but it's the prophets. We had, for I think like every book of the Bible, I think we had in the library, except for I think Job. They didn't have Job. And they didn't have Proverbs. I think those were the two main ones they didn't have, because they were too long and because they don't regularly read from them. But any books of the prophets, anything you read from in the synagogue, they had. So I think also Psalms didn't exist, but there's one down in the Western Wall. Someone actually commissioned a book of Psalms as a scroll in the Western Wall on the men's side. So that's the first. That's that problem. But then we have the question of paraphrasing. So one of the problems that we have all the time is that when you look at the scrolls, and when you look at material, right, for example, when you compare Deuteronomy to the rest of the Torah, when there are laws which are parallel to one another, you have a basic problem that sometimes it feels like a contradiction. This contradiction is actually superficial, because what basically you're dealing with is a paraphrase of another law, and the paraphrasing is intended to present the law from a different perspective, because everything has different perspectives. You can look at law, you can look at situations from different perspectives, and this is really what it's doing. So one of the things that I've been dealing with in this past week is this question of paraphrasing, because I've reached a point in my paper where I'm literally comparing sections to one another and comparing bits and pieces to one another. And the thing is that, first of all, I have to say, by the way, just because probably some of you are wondering what my conclusion is. My conclusion is that it's actually inconclusive. The reason I say it's inconclusive is because there are elements, and a lot of them, which are very, very early, but it's quite possible that there are, from a scholarly perspective, from a research perspective, there might be sections in Deuteronomy that were updated later on in a latter stage. And maybe someone in Jerusalem sat down, took the core book that they had of Deuteronomy, and added bits and pieces to it, under the authority, obviously, of a prophet. It wasn't done just because someone could. This is not something they did randomly. especially when you take the story of the book of Deuteronomy, where it's assumed that was the book of Deuteronomy was discovered by King Josiah. And they went to Huldah, who was a prophetess, and they asked her. So obviously they understood that there's a need for intervention here of a prophet. But the thing that basically I came up with was that when you look at the material, it's very inconclusive from the academic perspective, because you see elements of both. Now, why is this important? What's for at least in my opinion, what's important here is that what it demonstrates is that scholars, no matter where they from what angle they come from, scholarship is based on not only evidence, but also on what people's notions are. What a person is trying to find and prove when they're reading something. Now, this is true about any data. This is true about any information. And when we go through the book of Deuteronomy, there are going to be cases where you might have read a law in one way, and I might tell you, look, I think it means something different. Or we might see a verse, and I'm going to say one thing, and you're going to see something different. Why? Because we might be reading these items from different perspectives. And this is quite normal. So when it comes to the book of Deuteronomy, one of the first issues that we have is the differences. Now, there's a scholar called Berman. He is from the Bar-Ilan University. And I actually today, usually Sunday is not the day that I deal with this material, but it happened to be. But Berman, for example, has this principle that he goes by where he says that if we look at different Hittite documents, we will find, I mentioned this last week as well, we will find material that indicates that even in treaties of the same king, we will still find rewritings. So we'll find a rewriting. And the rewriting is not evidence of forgery or anything of the sort, because the principle was that when you write a covenant, you also have a copy of the covenant, which means that when you approach, the king writes a new covenant and he sends it with his officers. And when he sends it with his officers, he goes ahead and they take this document, they bring it to the king, and the scribe reads it out to the king. And the king goes like, wait, that's not what the original says. Bring the original. So he opens, looks at it, and says, oh, look, it's not exactly the same. But that's not a problem. They wouldn't do that. They wouldn't react in that way. And why wouldn't they react in that way? Because it was perfectly normal to change details based on the necessity. So why am I saying all of this? Because literally something that I wrote inside my paper, which I did not mention last week, but something I literally wrote inside the paper, is some of the material we're going to see in chapter one. And in chapter one, there, not only in chapter one, in the rest of the book as well, there are some contradictions. And people, one of the very, very common things that, for example, I hear and have heard from different scholars, including a scholar that was a delight to speak with. She was pretty interesting. But I think she made a small mistake. And her mistake, now that I know some material, her mistake is a very important one. But her mistake stems from the fact that she's probably not doing the exact same work that I am doing, the comparative work that I'm doing. And what she was trying to argue was that the book of Deuteronomy has a different tradition with what happened with Moses. That Moses really didn't, it wasn't really that he suffered, it wasn't really a whole bunch of different things. She kind of rejected a whole bunch of ideas, and she says, look, I think that Deuteronomy is presenting a different tradition in regards to the history of Moses. And I still have somewhere in the piles of paper that I have behind me her paper, and I need to look at it again to see. But Now, you know, 2 months later, whatever it is, it's almost 2 months later, after reading all the material that I read, I think she's completely wrong. I think that what she's done is that she's read it as an isolated piece of material without taking into consideration the ideas that stand behind when you write something. So one of the ideas I've actually suggested to in my paper as well, but also to my head professor, was maybe to write a thesis about scribal practices and scribal traditions in the Hebrew Bible. He will probably tell me to select like a very specific chapter to deal with. And basically use that as a platform to try to develop more of this discussion about, you know, why is the Bible constructed the way it's constructed and so on. And he said, by the way, he said that this was a great idea and he thought that this was a really interesting thing to do. However, he said, look, if you're going to do the work on the Dead Sea Scrolls, maybe it's a better idea that you utilize that and write your thesis about the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is very tempting, by the way. But what came up was that, and this is something that Dr. Danel, who I'm writing the paper on Deuteronomy, said, the principle paraphrasing is actually very, very common. You find paraphrasing all over the place. And the paraphrasing itself is normal. And when you have parallel stories or stuff like that, the thing I'm noticing is that there's a fundamental flaw in the way a lot of scholars approach the Bible, because they're always trying to be naysayers. They're always trying to find, like, what's the little thing that I can prove you that maybe there's something else going on here? And what I've noticed throughout the work that I've done, and this has absolutely nothing to do with my religious beliefs. This is actually something that I'm just looking at. I'm saying, look, I'm looking at this person's evidence and this person's evidence. And I just, this is my response, that paraphrasing doesn't mean complete diversion. And paraphrasing doesn't mean, when I say diversion, I mean completely different tradition or something. And paraphrasing is still a mechanism of imitation. So when Moses presumably contradicts himself, or there's a contradiction between what Moses says and what we find in the rest of the Torah, this is actually a false contradiction. The material is designed deliberately, and I have evidence of this. I actually, one of the things that I did is I said, look, everyone's arguing about these different structures and everything, and everyone's saying, oh, look, you know, you can't really show that Esal Chadon, this is an imitation of Esal Chadon. And I said, look, even Esal Chadon himself, and I actually have a document, I have two documents, and I show them. Even Esal Chadon himself didn't write exactly the same each time he presented a treaty to someone. He had to fit the treaty to the situation. He can't just say, oh, I'm just going to copy this down. This is not, for example, I don't know how it works in the US, but for example, in Israel, there's a very, very common thing that you can download off the net, a standard contract, for example. I think you can download these things in the United States as well. And it's very common here in Israel. There's standard contracts you can download. It's pretty acceptable and so on. But what if the situation is not exactly the same? What if a standard contract doesn't work because there's a specific situation? So what do? You do an addendum. You sit down and you read through the contract and you say, look, this doesn't work because our situation is such and such. So you pull out a pen. Okay, you start writing the addendum on the side, and you both sign on the addendum. And that's basically what has to be done. Same thing with the Book of Deuteronomy. The Book of Deuteronomy has a very, very precise purpose. And the purpose is introduced multiple times throughout the entire book. And it goes like this. You're about to enter the land. You have to be loyal to the God of Israel, and you are in a contract. If I sum it up into 3 points, even though there's a little bit more than that. And the loyalty clause is so fundamental that in my original paper, by the way, I quoted every single place. I decided to cut back because it was just too many. It was like 20 plus cases. I cut back it down to like 10 or something just to make a point. But the thing that basically came up was that the word ahava, which is really a word for loyalty, it doesn't just mean love. It's not like the ichlebedik. It's not like I just, you know, I love you and that's it. As I've written in an article, you know, loving God, what does it actually mean in the Hebrew, in the book of Deuteronomy, most in the book of Deuteronomy? Deuteronomy has a very, very high frequency of number of cases where the word love is used. And even though it's not very common in the Hittite documents, there's some allusions to it. And it was really a funny situation this morning because I realized I have a book here that I've read before that has a short article about the use of the word love in Deuteronomy. And I suddenly felt like a dum-dum because I completely forgot I actually had that article. But out of all the books that I have here, thank God for all the books that I have. Great blessing. You know, it's easy to forget. But what's very, very important is that when you read through it, everything is sandwiched through this idea of you need to be loyal. You need to be loyal. If it's alluded to in Numbers and in other places, if a little bit here and there, Deuteronomy projects this with gigantic neon lights. And the reason it does this is because there's a new threat. In the desert, the threat was rebellion. In the land of Israel, the threat is much more complicated. Now, here's the weird thing. Here's really the weird thing. This consistently happens. We live now in the land of Israel as a sovereign nation. And we're unfortunately messing up again. It's really bizarre, because the state of Israel is a secular state. The moment you connect us to this land, this thing switches on in our heads, and we go like, we can rebel because we're free, we have our own land, and so on. We completely forget where it comes from. And this is why Deuteronomy emphasizes over and over and over again this idea of be loyal, love your God, and he will love you back. Literally, do a test. Put in a search for the word love in the book of Deuteronomy, and you'll see that the frequency in comparison to the other parts of the Torah is extremely high. And it's not by chance. This is because the book of Deuteronomy is what it is. Now, so that's a very, very central thing, the book of Deuteronomy, and everything really surrounds it. Now, if we go back to the whole story of Exodus, the other side of the book of Deuteronomy as well is this principle of redoing a covenant and redoing a covenant. And what Deuteronomy is basically focusing on is this pinnacle that you go up to a mountain, and unlike Mount Sinai, everyone is allowed to be on this mountain, and you do sacrifices. And there's a ceremony there with priests and so on. And the site was obviously discovered, as I've pointed out many times in the past. And what's very, very, very important here is to understand that the book of Deuteronomy is almost like a new covenant. It paraphrases parts of the Torah. It brings up new rules that you have to pay attention to. But what it's also doing is it's saying, look, this is like a new covenant. It's based on the older versions of this covenant, but it's a new one because the situation has changed. This is why Jeremiah, who, by the way, has very strong links to the book of Deuteronomy. There are multiple researches that deal with this, but the thing that came up was that there are strong links with Jeremiah. And I think everyone already knows exactly what I'm talking about, because in Jeremiah, I think it's either 30 or 31, it says, I will cut with you a new covenant. Is it a new covenant? Is it a renewed covenant? I get asked that question all the time. And in truth, it's both. it's a renewal of a covenant, but it has a new variation of it because of a new situation. And that's really how it works. You base yourself on a core idea that's how you fundamentally build your covenant. And then throughout time, as you progress, you might need to do something that allows you to make the covenant relevant to your time. That's, by the way, part of the principle of oral Torah. All the attacks, for example, in oral Torah that people have is a misunderstanding of the necessity of allowing Torah to be a living, breathing element. They renewed covenants all the time. Moses presents the covenant of the Torah in a slightly different way when he talks about laws, which I already mentioned in the Torah earlier, because this was common practice. You need to present the material in a way that makes sense to the generation you're in. It doesn't, but here's the core thing. Here's the most important thing. It doesn't mean you rip out the core. What you do is you work around that core. The core never changes. It's the situations around the core that change. And what does Moses do? He says, look, here's the core. Here's the situations you might go into. And you have to, through the core, try to understand how to make the covenant relevant to what you're doing right now. And that's a really, really important thing. And this is why I think that a lot of people, scholars, regular people, Karaites, Rabbinites, and so on, they misunderstand the situation, because there is this principle of renewal of the covenant through the new situation you're in. And I think that idea is lost with a lot of people. And I think the research I've done in the last couple of months really has demonstrated this. And it's a very, very good question, Kimberly. I'll get to that in a second. I'll explain the issue with that verse. So we see that there's this idea. The question, and this is what Kimberly's asking, is how does not adding or taking away fit into the idea of renewal and adapting to the situation? So first of all, we have to separate facts of reality, what people actually did, versus theoretical principles which appear in the text. Because this is always the problem. There's theoretical law and then there's actual practical law. Whatever you think is the law sometimes doesn't really apply. Like, for example, conversation I had today with my accountant. What is the legal standing of a certain economic issue that I'm asking? And he said to me, look, you know, there's a clause in the law that says this, this, and that. But in practicality, even if you say the law says this, you can actually interpret it as being that. And why can you interpret it being that? Because there's a practical side of the law. So what does it mean the Torah says don't add or subtract from the law? As I said, you have your core. And when you work with your core, what you're doing is you're basically using the core to interpret the situations you're in. The question that's raised is, what does it mean to add? So if, for example, I say, the Torah says you have to wear tzitzit, but we start discussing how many strings do you need to put in the tzitzit, okay? Is that really changing the law? Is that adding or subtracting from the law? Answer probably is it isn't. Because the Torah never gives us exactly how many strings you have to have. It actually never says that if you have more than one blue string, that there's a problem. It just says you make your tzitzit and you add a blue string. Now, this is a very simplistic case that I'm bringing up. There are much more complicated situations. So, for example, if the Torah says you're not allowed to eat the fat of the animal, certain fatty parts of the animal in the hindquarters and so on. Does this mean that if I go ahead and say I rather forfeit the entire hindquarters, which, by the way, I would never do because some of the best pieces are there. But if I decide to forbid the hindquarters because I'm worried that I might eat that forbidden fat, which is completely ridiculous, but that's besides the point. And I'm basically poking fun at rabbinic Judaism right now because some of it's very ridiculous. Have I added to the Torah, adding a prohibition? If I decide not to eat this, and I'm not saying this is forbidden, just I rather not because this has parts of it that are forbidden to eat, so I'm going to not eat the whole thing. Is that really a prohibition? It's dumb, but I don't really see the problem here. So one of the issues that we always have is people raise this verse, but okay, it's a very, very simple verse. Don't add, don't subtract. What are the parameters of this law? Is it just that? Don't add and subtract? Well, so what happens if I have a situation the Torah doesn't have a direct answer for? What do I do if I have a situation the Torah never talks about? How do you work around this? How do you have a functioning law if what I'm doing is I'm taking the book and say this is I'm taking the written material and saying, look, this is all I have. It's a really, really interesting gray area. And I think the question that Kimberly has raised is a very, very fundamental question. As a counter to that, I'm going to be very Jewish right now, as a counter to that, I have to ask the question of, what does that mean? What are you not allowed to take away or add? Because you can always enter a situation where you add something in criminal law. Like, for example, if you can't make a decision in regards to a case where it's either life or death and it's too obscure to answer, then what do you do with this person? So what we find very interestingly is the Torah says the blasphemer, for example, is put into prison. He's actually kept in custody until they hear an answer. So that's a really interesting situation because what they did there is that they already employed a punishment. Even the Torah never tells you that there's such a punishment. It's either this or that. Now, obviously it was a punishment that was temporary. It's a temporary punishment, but it's still a punishment. The problem that we have here right now is because I don't have in my head right now very precise situations or very precise cases. It's very difficult to really answer this question. So what I'm doing right now is I'm literally nitpicking. I'm literally sitting nitpicking like cases just at the top of my head. But what I've noticed throughout the years with discussions with Karaites, with people who are, you know, only keep the written Torah and so on, that they still have to find interpretations for situations they're in. And what happens is that it really goes into a lot of gray areas. There's a lot of gray areas that you have to be very, very careful with, and that's the problem of interpretation. When you produce an interpretation, and this is, by the way, something very fundamental in law and overall, the fact that you are presenting an interpretation automatically is a production of a meaning, which means you are on the spot adding or subtracting. And I am dead serious about this. An interpretation by its nature is a re-representation of the information that may or may not harm the original intent of what was being said. This is just a very, very basic principle that you have in reading text in overall. So you are always going to be in some way or another in a danger of adding or subtracting from the law. So the question that's raised is, as I said earlier, what exactly is the meaning of don't add or take away? And that's why I said, I think it revolves around a core. If you are still working with that specific core, you're perfectly fine. It's when you decide to take the core and say, oh, look, I'm going to take the core and add to the core. I think that's where the problem really lies. So if you decide that you want to read a verse in the most abstract way that possible, and you're going to say, this is everything the law has to say about that, then what you've done is that you've really used a very subjective way of reading a law that you might be removing from the law things which were intended in that law. So this is a catch 22. This verse is a catch 22 in a way that I think you're getting the idea why I'm saying it's a catch 22. So when Moses says don't take away or add, and when we think about the context of what that verse is really presented in, if I remember correctly, it has to do with the idea of idol worshiping, if I remember correctly. I think I remember this correctly, because I remember discussing this subject years ago with a friend, and I remember while reading the verse, I just kept on reading, and it dawned on me that the verse itself is not related, is not necessarily related to other things. I just don't remember exactly where each one is. Yeah, so here's this is even better, because this is literally a chapter I'm working with right now. So, it's actually chapter 13 in the Hebrew. And really what's very, very interesting here is the fact that immediately after that, it talks about a false prophet telling you to go worship another god. I think that it's actually sandwiched between worshiping other gods, and having false prophets. So that's a really, really interesting place to put this verse, because the verse is sandwiched between the two possible ways of someone changing the Torah, either just randomly deciding to worship another god, or having someone telling them do it. That's really, really interesting. This actually might be the context, but again, we have to be very careful with this idea of context, because basically what happens is that it really opens up, it opens a much larger process where basically from chapter 14, we start talking about actual laws, like, you know, for example, laws in chapter 14, you are the sons of the Lord your God, you will not cut yourself and put a bald spot between your eyes to the dead, for you are holy to the Lord your God, and he has chosen, and the Lord has chosen you to be his prized jewel from all the nations which are in the face of the earth. So it does open up to some degree this element of the laws themselves, but it's really interesting that it links the principle to the authority of a prophet. If we do, and again, interpretation, but if we do a reversal of the situation, then we also come into a situation where maybe a prophet is allowed to tell you, okay, this is something you're supposed to do. Now, how is this possible? Well, we have the famous case of Elijah. Just now, an article came out through the website called The Torah, which is a website that I go very upset with eventually, because I felt that the PhD who runs the website was being a little bit dishonest about one of the articles, and I kind of publicly said, well, this doesn't really fit. And the issue that basically came up was that they came up with an article about Elijah, and was Elijah really allowed to sacrifice basically do what he did? And the answer is, of course he was allowed. There are different ways of proving he was allowed, but one of the most fundamental sides of saying he was allowed was because he was an authority. He was a Torah authority by the pure fact that he was a prophet. So when we talk about Torah, are we talking really about a closed book that can never be opened by someone of authority, like a prophet? Or is there a core that everything is an offshoot of that core? Which is a very, very difficult question to answer. I, for example, last week or 2 weeks ago, I got an email from a guy who's Jewish, who's also, he's contemplating a lot. He's not sure. He's not sure if it's this or that. And he asked me where my standing is. And I said that, you know, I think that the rabbinic material has a lot to offer because it's a living, breathing version of the Torah, unlike Karaism, which is basically a very random collection of ideas. At least in rabbinic Judaism, there's some structure, not complete, but there's some structure. And he actually wrote back to me saying that it's exactly the rabbinic Judaism tends to overinterpret and add, and Karaism is complete chaos. Now, I didn't use the word chaos, he did. But I understand the sentiment that he was trying to present there. It's not complete chaos, but Karaites eventually also reached that point where I think there was a realization that you can't maintain a mechanism of law if anyone can interpret however they want, and that's where the problem lies. I mean, for example, I used to be of the opinion, oh, I just read and interpret, and you know, after years and years of studying but this is now my sixth year, I think, in academia, I see more shades of gray than I saw in the past. Some things are very straightforward. Some things are not that simple. And my attitude is that we need to try to diligently study as much as we can. And I think that if we all take upon ourselves a section of the Torah and really research it well, we can come up with a much better answer to some of these questions. So yes, this is a very, very fundamental verse. But yet, is he really saying you can't interpret things and through the interpretation reach some situation or interpret based on the situation you're in? Or is he really saying don't, and here's the catch, don't change the actual text? Now, this is a really, really important thing because, and this was the thing I was keeping up my short sleeve here, that we find in ancient Near Eastern documents this principle of you are forbidden to erase or change the words of this document. And I think this is the actual context. The context is don't touch the document. The interpretation, okay, it's perfectly fine. Like, for example, if I have a document that says to me, don't do agreements with our enemies. And I have a situation where someone is not exactly the enemy of the king, but he's kind of on the line there. Should I or shouldn't I? Can I do business with that person? It's a gray area. But I haven't changed anything in the text. It's pretty straightforward. You know, I haven't changed anything in the text. So I think that's really, if we think about what we would call the historical background, I think that's really what the context is. Don't touch the text itself, or don't change the text in a way where it obscures what's being said. You don't have the authority to do that. The only one with an authority to do that is God himself. And Jeff actually said it on the nose. Okay. Jeff actually said it on the nose. This is why Jeff is Jeff and I are so such good friends. He says, "We didn't change the covenant; the Almighty did." I was saving that one for now, because really, what we're talking about is that there's a mechanism of authority that allows someone to step into the material and say, look, I am the mouthpiece of God, and I'm telling you this is what needs to be done. That's the authority of Elijah. That's the Hosea, for example. Amos says, don't do sacrifices. We're not interested. Stop the sacrifices. Isaiah says, stop the sacrifices completely. What do you mean, stop the sacrifices completely? He's not saying there's no sacrifices in the Torah. What they're saying, unlike, for example, what Martin Bobel tried to argue, and obviously Wilhausen with his nonsense. Wilhausen was very, very biased. And it's also research from over 150 years ago. It's almost completely irrelevant. Actually, no, it's completely irrelevant these days. But what's very, very important is to understand that there's a living, breathing mechanism. And when prophecy officially stopped, where we couldn't really indicate actual prophets in the way like the prophets of old were, rabbis had to step in and say, look, we're a bit of a kerfuffle here. We don't have prophecy. We have a problem. And we need to make sure that this mechanism can continue working. So you have to sometimes make tough choices. It's sometimes a reality of making tough choices. We don't live in an ideal reality. This is the principle of exile. If there was a prophet like Moses with us, then there wouldn't be any questions. If we had the high priest, then there wouldn't be any questions. And as Michael says, maintain the stability to survive. As I said, we have a problem. And by the way, I would understand if people disagree with me, but as a person who's lived Torah his entire life and has studied the history of the situations and has a father who happens to be a rabbi and knows a lot of people, a lot of different places, the thing that I've been able to kind of like take in throughout the years and years of discussing things with people, and people from all walks of life, all styles and everything, people know that sometimes you can't do anything, you can't do things 100%. Sometimes you have to somehow figure it out. And you have to build a mechanism that will allow you to deal with the situation you're in. Because if you don't allow some level of flexibility not through the core, but flexibility around how you work with the core, you literally won't survive. Your mechanisms will not survive. Your mechanisms will literally fall apart at some point. And this is the problem with over-literalism, and this is also the problem with under-literalism, with too much... too much interpretation that takes things out of what they really meant. So a lot of people like raising the flag of, look, we're against rabbinic Judaism because of the oral Torah. But that's more of a slogan. For example, there's this principle in politics that if you want to bedazzle people, all you have to do is throw around slogans. You're not really saying anything. And And it's a mechanism used to defame people all the time. It's like the famous scene from Monty Python where there are two guys arguing. So instead of answering what the guy is actually saying, he's calling him Big Nose. Okay? He's defaming him to divert the discussion from what's really going on. So for example, Netanyahu just got charged with two cases of bribery and one case of... infringement of loyalty. The law is called in English. I don't remember what it's called in Hebrew right now. And one of the things that basically came up was I was listening to the news and I'm listening how different people from the opposition and from the coalition and so on, how they're responding to this, and lawyers, each lawyer interpreting and so on. And what was really, really interesting is that every time I listened to someone from the opposition, what I noticed is that where they were mostly throwing slogans, there was no actual discussion about what these allegations are about. It was mostly slogans. And when they actually had a real lawyer sit down, real lawyers sit down and talk about this, you could hear the real different opinions. So I think that, yes, I think that there is a problem with rabbinic Judaism, and I've said this for years already, but I don't think it's correct to use that verse of adding and subtracting as a real piece of evidence that what's done in rabbinic Judaism is completely wrong. But again, going back to what we said earlier, it seems to be, if we pay attention to, and we have to be, and again, we have to be very, very careful while comparing things. The fact that I use stuff in the ancient Near East doesn't mean that it's exactly the same, or that's even correct. I actually say this in my paper. I openly say that we have to be very, very careful with these comparisons. So if we summarize what I've said in the last hour, is that we have a core concept known as the Torah, and based on the situations people are in, you are allowed to use the core to prove that something is supposed to be done one way or the other. And based on the authority of a prophet can sometimes step in and do something that might contradict something else that appears in the Torah, but he's doing this with authority. And also that we have the problem that any interpretation can anyhow bring you to a situation where you're adding and subtracting. And I want to take one last example here that came to mind. Think about Solomon's temple. I had a discussion years ago, back in 2014, I want to say, either end of 13 or beginning of 14. I had a discussion with a Samaritan. There's a very nice Samaritan that I know called Binyamin Tzedakah. He's very well known. He travels around the world. We actually have mutual friends from around the world as well. And the thing that came up was that we were talking about the Samaritan temple. And bringing up the Samaritan temple, we also talked about Solomon's temple. And he says to me, obviously the Samaritans have their own attitude towards it. Oh, Solomon and his father rebelled against the original temple of Mount Gerizim, and they built a temple in Jerusalem, which was not okay. Let's put that one aside for now. That's the ideology of the Samaritan movement. There's a much more important thing that was said there. And he said, but the Samaritans didn't have a temple. We only had a tabernacle. And I was like, really? And he said, yes. And I said to him, why? He said, because the Torah says there's a tabernacle. There's no actual temple. So I said to him, so what you're telling me is that here on Mount Gerizim, you basically had the tabernacle of Moses up to a certain point until that tabernacle was somehow removed. And he says to me, yes. I said to him, really? What do you do with the fact that we actually know as a fact that there was an actual building on that site and that building's been reconstructed and it strongly resembles a temple? And we could see signs that there was worship there. Oh no, that's a false reading. The archaeologists who dug there misunderstood. I gave him a funny look and I said, could it be that what you're doing is you're trying to protect the fact that the Samaritans didn't keep the Torah exactly, and really what they did is they actually had their own temple there as well? He says, no, there was the tabernacle, and something happened. We don't know what happened to the tabernacle. It vanished in some way or another. We don't know. I said to him, okay. Now, he raised a really interesting question here, because regardless of the Samaritan propaganda that I was listening to, because I know the fact that he's completely wrong about it, and Binyamin is a friend, but with all due respect, Samaritans do a lot of stuff that is not even close to what the Torah says. It's pretty shocking, some of the things they do, how they interpret things, because what they were doing is they were adapting. So, for example, they build the sukkah indoors and they hang fruits, which is How does that have to do with anything? It's not a sukkah. It's not even what a sukkah really is. Or they, for example, couldn't wear tzitzit anymore outwards, because what happened was that Jews started showing up again in the land of Israel, and the Muslims here saw the Jews with the tassels, and they looked at the Samaritans who were living mixed with them, and they saw the Samaritans wear tassels, so they kind of put 1 + 1, and they started grouping the Samaritans together with the Jews. So the Samaritans abandoned the idea of wearing tzitzit, and now they claim that the original wear of wearing tzitzit was to have like 12 buttons on their garment, which, by the way, these buttons are just buttons, button-up shirts that Muslims used to wear as well. And they, some of them put something on the sleeve as well, which, again, this is something, they have like a long sleeve, and this would be something. A lot of weird stuff. But in the synagogue itself, the high priest actually wears a four-cornered garment that looks like a tallit. So the stuff that the Samaritans do, which is again their interpretation, because they were adapting. The reason they built a sukkah indoors is because they were in danger when they slept outside. The Samaritans, for example, blow the shofar on Yom Teruah, even though the Torah never really directly says you have to blow the shofar. There's a lot of things of understanding written law, principle of law versus practicality of law. We have to always be very, very careful with this. But what's the issue here with King Solomon's temple? If that God said only build a tabernacle, then what allowed King Solomon to build a temple? Now, as I've explained before, the building of the temple was considered to be like this pinnacle, this high point from the Exodus. This is why the Prayer of Solomon starts from this idea that the opening there, chapter 8 in 1 Kings chapter 8, is on the 480th year of from the Exodus and so on. Why is that? Why do we have this very, very unusual opening? And the reason is because this very dramatic opening is supposed to link the Exodus to the building of the temple, as the building of the temple being the pinnacle, the final stage, the final scene of the Exodus, which we hear a little bit of this idea in the Song on the Sea. Mikdash Adonai konenu yadecha, the house of the Lord your hands have established. It's not there by chance. It's there because there's an ideal. The moment a god puts the foundation of his kingdom, he builds a palace. This is something that we've seen throughout the entire ancient Near East. Now, by doing this, what we're actually seeing is that there's an expectancy for God to have a temple. So King Solomon goes ahead and builds a temple, even though the Torah says, make me a temple out of this and that and so on and so forth. So what did King Solomon do? He imitated the tabernacle inside he made a wooden box covered with gold, with a veil and so on and so forth. And then he took that box and surrounded it with stone. And he's basically telling, if I may say it this way, he's basically telling himself, look, this is still the tabernacle. It's just different. It's different. It's just, I've covered it with stone, but I've basically reconstructed the tabernacle. Now, the second temple was a much more complicated thing, because the second temple was a whole story by itself. But again, we go into Ezekiel, and Ezekiel says, build a temple. But doesn't the Torah say, make a tent, make a tabernacle? So again, we're looking at a situation where the temple is perfectly fine, because we've moved into a different situation where we need something larger and more central. So far, when the tribes were just tribes, a tabernacle was enough. Now that we are scattered around the land, and we also have a centralized system, we need a larger temple so people can show up in mass and so on. Because if you've ever been to the site of the site where they assume the Shiloh tabernacle was, it is tiny. If you can fit there 1,000 people, I'll be a chicken. Seriously, I once attended a wedding in an open space, and there were 700 of us there, and the space was 3 times bigger than the site of the Tabernacle of Shiloh, And it was still very crowded. So when you reach a point where you expect everyone to show up at one temple, you have to adapt. You have to build up your adaption abilities to the situation you're in. Now, as I promised, we only have a couple more minutes left for today's class. I did say we're going to start, so I'm going to bring up the text. And there's something very, very important regarding this text that I need to bring up. So we're only going to talk about the first five verses here. And the first five verses are, when I sat down to read what these five verses actually probably mean, I was very, very, very surprised. Because I always pondered about these verses. So first, the book of Deuteronomy is called Sefer Devarim. In this case, because Ele HaDevarim, these are the words. So Devarim is the plural form of the word words. So it says, Ele HaDevarim, Asher Diber Moshe El Kol Yisrael. These are the words which Moses spoke to all of Israel. Now, here's the thing. This is where the catch is about this chapter. It actually mentions loads of places which are not even close to one another. And we'll start going on over them. Be'ever ha-Yerden. Ever ha-Yerden is a very interesting term because this term really is, from historical material, only shows up in the Assyrian period. And it could be that this is, but it's also possible that the Assyrians, and that this is why, for example, I avoided stuff like this in my paper because you'll never see the end of it. But it's possible the Assyrians use the term Ever HaYerden, and this is just showing how you can reverse everything that some scholars say. They might have learned it from the people who lived here, and then they wrote it down. So they showed up, and they said, what would you call this place? Oh, Abber Naharu, or Abber Yerdanu. Oh, it's the other side of the river. Okay, scribe, call this area the other side of the river. And then they carried on. It doesn't mean that the Assyrians invented this name. The way to prove or disprove such an argument is you have to check what other groups called this area. And the problem is we don't really have the names that people use of this area. So as far as I'm concerned, it's quite possible they came here, they spoke with the residents of the area, and they said, what do you call this place? Ever HaYerden. Okay, right down, the other side of the river. So again, it's the issue of how do you read data. The problem is I don't want to nitpick little words, little bits and pieces here and there. So then it says Bamidbar, in the desert, Ba'arava mul suf. Wait. Where are we? Ba'arava. The Arava is down south. Mul suf, in parallel to the place known as Suf. That doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Because when we look at the map of the area, this is Ever HaYerden. It's up here. The Arava is down here. This is where the Arava is. Mol Suf is down here. So we have to start asking ourselves questions. What on earth is going on here? So then it says, Ben Paran Uven Tofel, between a place called Paran, and a place called Tofel, and a place called Lavan, Velavan, and Vachatzerot, Vedizahav. So there's multiple places, Tofel, Lavan, Chatzerot, and Dizahav. Where are these places located? Well, we have Lavan is somewhere here, near Kuntila. Dizahav is assumed to be all the way down here. Chatzerot is in Ein Chatzrat. This is a place called Dahab Chatzrat. The Arabs actually maintained Wadi El Bicha, which I think means the white Wadi. Chatzira or Chachira, which is Chatzerot. Some people say maybe Lavan is up here. I'm very skeptical of this one because this one is on the road and they didn't use that road. But there's multiple places mentioned here. It says, Achadasar Yom Mechorev, 11 days from Chorev, Derech Har Seir, through Mount Seir, Ad Kadesh Barnea. So now he says it's 11 days from, if you travel 11 days from Chorev, through Mount Seir, you reach a place called Kadesh Barnea. Well, Kadesh Barnea is over here, in the middle of the Negev, because really the state of Israel kind of goes like that-ish. So Kadesh Barnea is a place you can actually visit today as well. I haven't been there, but I was not too far away. Okay, and we have this place here. So this is Kadesh Barnea. Okay, so this is a really, really, really interesting situation where it's very unclear who's where. So the assumption is that what he's actually talking about is, and this would explain why we have what I point out to the, what I started pointing out to earlier, is that we're actually looking at pieces that Moses spoke loads and loads of different things in different places. And what happened was that when he sat down to read to write this book, the Book of Deuteronomy, he collected all of his speeches and put them side by side. And this is why you have rough places. Scholars love saying, look, there's a rough place here, there's a rough place there, a rough place, you know. Going back to old MacDonald from last week, for those that remember, we had a whole joke, here, thing, there, thing, and then Kimberly wrote EIO. But the point is that the roughness doesn't come from different writers or anything of the sort. It's because Moses is sitting down and taking a lot of speeches, a whole bunch of speeches that he said throughout the years, and put them side by side. Now, this is actually really, really important, because what it demonstrates is the idea that Moses renewed the covenant and emphasized the covenant, not just here. He did it multiple times through the desert, but we only hear about it fragmented here when we have all these different locations, which most definitely are not next to one another. I remember reading this years ago, even as a kid, and I could never understand, because I kind of knew where all these different places were, and I couldn't make sense of it. How does any of this fit together? Until finally, after 30 years, I sit down and read a commentary, and he says, look, these are all different places, and he suggests the idea that we're talking about multiple speeches given over an extended period of time, and not one long, extensive speech, as we've always assumed. Why do we assume this? Because of what happens in the next couple of verses. It says, "Vayhi b'arba'im shanan." It was in the 40th year, "Bashtei asar chodesh," on the 11th month. "Ashtei asar" is another variant of "ahad asar." Appears in other Semitic languages. Hebrew tends to have variations of different words in different places. So, on the 11th month, "Be'ehad l'chodesh," okay, on the first of the month, "Diber Moshe b'nei Yisrael," Moses spoke to the children of Israel, "Kechol asher tziva Adonai oto alehem," as the Lord commanded him. Why? Because he has to renew the covenant. Okay? And this structure, this verse, causes us to think that we're talking about one unit. But really, this is just the opening. The opening is, I have a collection of ideas here, and I have to present an opening. And this is what this really is. And it gives us a few more statements. It says, "Acharei akoto et Sichon melech ha'emori." After he struck Sichon, the king of the Amorites, we read in the Book of Numbers, "Asher yoshev b'cheshbon," which sits the Cheshbon, which is Tel Hisban, which has been excavated, "Ve'et Og melech ha'bashan," Og, the king of Bashan, "Asher yoshev ba'ashtarot u'be'edre'i," who dwells at a place called Ashtarot and a place called Edre'i. Two places, he had probably two main cities that he lived in. So why is this mentioned? Because again, we're talking about, we're about to enter the land, and God has proven his loyalty. There's a reason for each one of the pieces being put here. It's not just a time reference. There's another thing being hinted here. It says, Be'ever Erden Be'eretz Moav. Now, we're again narrowing everything down to this one place and bridging with the beginning of verse 1. Be'ever Erden Be'eretz Moav, in the other side of the river, in the land of Moav, Ho'il Moshe, Moshe was willing, Ho'il Moshe be'er et ha-Torah hazot lemor. Moses was willing to explain this Torah, saying, and we're actually going to stop here because now we go into another piece. And anyhow, this is a very, very long chapter, so there's a lot to say along the way. But what's very important is Moses is now explaining the Torah to the people. And it's really interesting that he uses this term be'er, which, by the way, not to be confused with a be'er with a segol under the aleph, which means a well. This is bi'ur, leva'er. It's to interpret, to explain. It's very interesting he does this because what he's really doing is that he's making it clear. He's explaining the Torah to the people. What's very interesting, he spends a very long time explaining the principle of loyalty, because that's really the most fundamental thing about the book of Deuteronomy. It's not the laws. I mean, I love the book of Deuteronomy because of the laws, because I'm a very law-oriented person. But what was much more interesting to discuss is that the principle of loyalty is in the core of everything that's being said here. And this is what made David so great, that David, even though he transgressed against the law in different occasions, his loyalty was the thing that kept him on his feet, that kept him in good relations with God, because he wouldn't let go of the loyalty. And when he made a mistake, he turned around to God and said, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. He wasn't arrogant about it. He wasn't argumentative about it. He said, look, I made a mistake. I have to pay for the mistake. And it's very interesting that Moses does, but it's very important also to point out that physical actions, practical actions are fundamental for the expression of loyalty to a covenant. You just kind of say, oh, I just believe. It doesn't fit what covenants are about. And this is why Moses can't just talk about be loyal, be loyal, be loyal. You have to show your loyalty. The loyalty is expressed through multiple things, including showing up at the temple, but more generally, keeping the Torah in overall. So Moshe, his explanation here is how to link the Torah in the right way into your life to make Torah a real living thing, and that is the principle of keeping covenant. You don't just say, I believe. You also have to do actions. And Moshe puts these pieces together. And this is really what he does here. And now's the time for comments, questions, because we are actually almost out of time. Actually, we are out of time, but I'm going to give some time to ask questions. It's a really complicated thing. I think the question that Kimberly asked is probably the most aggravating part, at least for me, to discuss the book of Deuteronomy. Probably the most difficult side that I have to deal with, because the book of Deuteronomy throws that verse at us with no mercy whatsoever and says, deal with it. And it's a very, very difficult, it's a very, very difficult verse. But I said, I told everyone from the beginning, for those who were here from the beginning and so on, I said, when we get to the book of Deuteronomy, expect a very, very interesting ride, because there's a lot to say. There's a lot to say all the time. Does someone ask something? Okay, yeah. Oh, Catherine, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, not with the distance between them. And again, we have a basic problem with this issue of locations. The space in between, you can put millions of people and there will still be space to especially if you're camping, there's enough space for millions of people there over and over, several times over. And Moses, you know, what is he doing? Running marathons while talking, running from one location to the other. I understand what you're saying, but it's too, it's, these places are too far apart from one another. I think it didn't catch up in the recording. So what Catherine was asking is, like, we have all these different locations and they're pretty scattered around the map. And we have a problem. You know, there's this question, like, you know, could it be possible that the multitude of people would hold up such a space? But then on the other hand, you have to think that when they enter the land, they take up even a larger space and they still have loads of room for everyone. So I think that the idea of putting an encampment of several million people in a valley or something and so on, is, or hundreds of thousands of people in a certain large area is still plausible. Obviously, you know, when you start thinking about cities that don't have skyscrapers or cities that don't have large buildings, then people are scattered on larger spaces. But again, we have to think about the statistics of how much space would a person take up in the ancient world, how much space each family would take up, but how many square feet or square meters would a person need for their environment. And this is, again, goes back into a discussion I think we've had here before about the size of Jerusalem. That there are scholars who say, look, Jerusalem wasn't as big as you think, and there were probably only about 5,000 people living there. And then there's another scholar who says, no, there's obviously 10,000 people living there. There's another scholar who says 30,000 people. But what they're doing is they're calculating the statistics of the space a person would take up based on whatever invented parameter they come up with. So how much space would a person take up with his flock and everything back in the ancient world? Is a very, very good question. The problem is we don't have these statistics. There's no way of knowing. Statistics, you want even more than that. Even in periods where statistics were much more accurate, we have a problem that, for example, the government of Russia and basically Poland, because it's very difficult to call it Poland, but they were talking about an X amount of Jews who lived there. And even then, we know as a fact that they didn't really know how many Jews were living there, because they didn't know how many children the Jewish family would have. They wouldn't know how much space each child would take up. They would look into a house and they'll see two beds, and they wouldn't know that in those two beds, 10 people sleep. You know, it's a lot of, like, these little parameters that really affect the way you understand statistics. So, for example, you know, there's this big question about what happened in Eastern Europe, that according to the statistics from the late 1700s and the early 1800s, there were only 750,000 Jews living in Eastern Europe. And then there's a guy called Shlomo Sand, who's a failed historian, but he's failed also because he's very anti-Zionist, and he tries to do everything that he can to prove that Zionism is racism and so on. And he goes into a lot of weird stuff, and he argues, oh, most of the Jews are not real Jews. Because now, what does he do? He takes a statistic that comes from a period where we know as a fact everyone was hiding people from an area that Jews multiplied in hundreds of percents faster than the local population of Poles and Russians and so on, in a place where they hid people as well, so you never really knew how many people are really there. And he says, look, from 750,000, it's impossible for 3 million people to show up. Look at the state of Israel. 20 years ago, we were 4 million. We've doubled our numbers in 20 years. So it's always a really, really interesting question of statistics and how many people can fit and so on. It's a very, very complicated matter. I remember when I was studying this, I couldn't wrap my head around the whole all the different details, because it's just impossible to make a decision what statistic is actually right, because there's so many factors that go into the decision making that I couldn't really pinpoint any of them. Okay, so I'm going to wrap this up. So this was the 3rd of March 2000.